please welcome Mrs. Sylvia Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the Monterey Conference Center for the 15th annual Panetta Institute Lecture Series. Can you imagine? We've been doing this for 15 years. And some of you have been with us since the beginning. Time goes by, doesn't it? So much has changed for our nation and our world in the 15 years since we've launched this series. We've witnessed large-scale events like the 9/11 attacks, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Hurricane Katrina, the collapse of Wall Street, and a deep recession. On a more individual level, we've seen remarkable advances in technology that have changed lives across the globe. This season, we reflect on these changes and transformations and the impact that they have on us, on our nation, and on our world. This year's theme is Revolutions of the 21st Century, Changing Our Way of Life. Indeed, changing our way of life. As we consider the events of the past 15 years, what can we expect from the future? How can we respond to new crises, new voices, and new inventions, and yet understand the consequences of these changes on our lives and on our future? Tonight, we'll discuss U.S. foreign policy and the Middle East. This afternoon, the speakers and I met with a large group from the Central Coast and beyond. These are students from all around the Central Coast here, going up north as far up as Vallejo. We had 640 students. We are so proud of that. The University Center ballroom was filled. It was, and I can't tell you how wonderful it was to watch these students listening to our speakers. They were quiet. They were respectful, and they were asking wonderful questions, good questions, knowledgeable questions. You could tell that they had learned a lot, not only at school, but also from Dr. Kazarian, who is our professor at the Panetta Institute, who taught them for the hour and a half before. For many of these young people, there is no memory of a time when our nation was not at war in the Middle East. They are also the same age as the young Arab men and women who in the past year have taken to the streets to demand a new future for themselves and for their nations. For all young people in the world, it's clear that the future of our nations and our global community is directly affected by the events taking place in the Middle East. A trip to the gas station makes that very clear. I know from my discussions with Leon the stubborn complexity of conflict in this region. Historic, ethnic, tribal, religious, regional, and cultural differences are responsible for deep-seated conflicts and perilous power struggles. The result is dangerous unrest and instability. For this reason, the long-time objective of United States policy is to build international consensus on the way forward. Libya was a successful NATO effort to return that country to the Libyan people. Tunisia and Egypt are working to create new governments. The ability of these nations to form democratic, self-sustaining governments will have a powerful impact on the future of the region and our own national security. The Arab League is playing a more constructive role in promoting peace in the Middle East. But as our own history tells us, democracy is clearly a messy process. What will these new nations look like? And what will their relations be with one another and with the United States. Mixed with these questions are growing humanitarian concerns regarding the violence in Syria, the threat of a nuclear Iran, and potential conflict with Israel, and growing turmoil from Yemen to Bahrain to Lebanon and Pakistan. Tonight, we will discuss the important region with two foreign policy experts. Their vast areas of knowledge include counterterrorism, national security, diplomacy, nuclear proliferation, and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. They'll give us their firsthand insight and perspectives on the current state of affairs and their projections for the future. Our first guest has held a variety of top diplomatic and foreign policy posts in both Democratic and Republican administrations. He has played a leading role in shaping United States involvement in the Middle East peace process and relations in the greater region. He recently served as special assistant to President Obama and the National Security Council as senior director for the Central Region, which includes Israel, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He was also special advisor on Iran to Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. A highly skilled diplomat, he was a key player in the Middle East peace process in both the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations. He is the author of several books on foreign policy and is now serving as counselor at the Washington Institute. Please welcome Ambassador Dennis Ross. Returning to our lecture series for a second time, our second guest is the former assistant to President George W. Bush for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. She served as deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism before becoming chair of the Homeland Security Council. As President Bush's leading terrorism advisor, she was responsible for issuing periodic reports on the threat to domestic security in the post-9/11 era. With access to sensitive intelligence, she assessed the strength and activities of al-Qaeda, and today she serves as a contributor for CNN and appears regularly on network and cable television as a counterterrorism, national, and homeland security expert. Please welcome Fran Townsend. Moderating the discussion is an experienced journalist and moderator who has covered the Middle East extensively and interviewed many of the key players in the region. A former anchor, White House correspondent, and interview host with CNN, he now serves as director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. Please welcome returning moderator Frank Sesno. All yours.
Well, thank you very much. I am very happy to be back. I know that we are all very much looking forward to the conversation that we are going to have here tonight. What an amazing time to be having it. Tonight's subject simply couldn't be more timely for any number of reasons, but before we begin on the conversation, I want to pay a special thanks and special recognition to the Panetta Institute, which for 15 years now has been bringing incredible, extraordinary people and conversations to California and to this region, and you are so fortunate to have this as part of your world here. And just hats off to Sylvia Panetta. As we mark the first anniversary of the extraordinary events and protests in Tahrir Square in Cairo, the fate of the nations in the Middle East remains uncertain and exceptionally volatile. We're all watching events very closely, and they seem to be changing almost literally by the day. So the questions are, what does this uncertain future hold for the people of the region, for the nations there and for our own nation's security. In fact, for the security of the world. So these two guests that we're here with this evening have studied the topic and lived the topic from virtually every angle, from counterterrorism to diplomacy, nuclear nonproliferation, Iran to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. They've been on the inside conducting negotiations and trying to be sure that very bad things don't happen to this country. And one other point that's well worth noting is that both of them have worked for presidents of different parties, multiple presidents, multiple parties. So you've spanned the politics of this as well. So let's get started. As we think about this region now, it's Iran. It's Israeli-Palestinian peace or lack of it. It is Egypt, Libya, Syria, young people, social media, Arab Spring, incredible uncertainty, tumult, and yes, oil. If you were in those jobs today, I think you probably wouldn't be getting any sleep at all. Dennis Ross, as you look at this region now, what do you watch most closely with all these things going on?
You know, the interesting thing is that if you look at the region as a whole, any one of the problems you just identified in the past would have been all-consuming, and it would have been enough for an administration. Now you're having to deal with all of them. What's the one that is most immediate from my concern? Most immediate one, the most urgent one for my concern is Iran and Iran's nuclear pursuit, nuclear weapons program.
Is it a nuclear weapons program?
I believe it is, yes. It's true that the intelligence community will say that they haven't made the final decision to actually turn the last screw and make a decision for a bomb. Everything they're doing is putting them in a position where they could confront the world with a fait accompli and you couldn't do anything about it. And from my standpoint, you know, the fact that they are developing the capability, that counts more than the intentions. So for me right now, that's the main preoccupation, because I think we have a window right now for diplomacy to work, in no small part because a context has been created where the Iranians are under enormous pressure and are feeling it for the first time. In the past, when they've been under great pressure, they have had a tendency to look for a way out to reduce the pressure. They're going to return to negotiations now. They're going to return to negotiations now under conditions that they rejected a year ago. That suggests that something is changing. It's not a guarantee, that's for sure. How they will make these decisions is something that remains to be seen. We can talk more about what I think the crucible is going to be when it comes to making that decision. But the other reason I think about this is because there is the question of what the Israelis feel they need to do. The Israelis look at Iran with nuclear weapons for completely understandable reasons as an existential threat. When you have a leadership that says you are a cancerous tumor and you need to be wiped out and they're developing the means to act on those words, you take it seriously. From an Israeli standpoint, they look at the diplomacy and they clearly believe in it. I say they clearly believe in it because the word crippling sanctions was something they coined.
Crippling sanctions. Crippling
sanctions. Right. The idea was put crippling sanctions on the Iranians, meaning the price will be so high they'll look for a way out. That was an Israeli concept. So that means they understand from their own standpoint that the best way to resolve this is through diplomatic means. The problem from their standpoint is, what if they don't work in time? And the question of time relates to, from an Israeli standpoint, their question, their concern is, Iran, given the nature, the depth, and the breadth of their infrastructure, their nuclear infrastructure, may reach a point where it is so developed that even if the Israelis were to strike militarily, it would make no difference.
Come back and we'll talk a lot more about Iran, I'm sure. Fran, let me let you take a shot at this, looking at this remarkable landscape and thinking, as you did, as the president's advisor on Homeland Security, the safety and security of this nation. What are you watching most closely now?
Well, there's no question. I shared Dennis's concern about Iran. Let's remember pre-9/11. First of all, Iran remains the single largest state sponsor of terrorism by their funding and arming of Hezbollah. Hezbollah, militarily the most capable, far-flung, deployed around the world, and has shown an ability to attack the United States going back to the Beirut barracks bombing. And so when you take the most powerful, worst weapons, that is a nuclear weapon, and imagine them in the hands of the worst people, a terrorist organization, I'm with Dennis. That keeps me up at night. I would add to the things that I'm watching, because I think it also is an early warning of what you're about to face. I add Syria to that. Syria is, we see both Iranian and Russian activity in support of the Assad regime. We see a degrading humanitarian situation. I'm concerned that the world isn't doing more, frankly. I say that, but I should add quickly, this is a much more difficult, complicated problem than Libya could ever have been. And so
Syria
is. Right. And so when you look there, not only is it a potential proxy battle dealing with the Iranians and the Russians for the West, but it is also a militarily more capable adversary. And we know, it's been publicly reported, there are more than 40 chemical and biological weapon sites under Assad regime control. So you've got international actors using Syria as a proxy battle. You've got a regime turning its own capability on its own people. And by and large, the world is standing by. I find that I find it unconscionable. I find it morally troubling. And I think in many respects, we will see the first wave of our conflict with Iran playing itself out in Syria.
I could tell this is going to be a thoroughly uplifting discussion this evening. But let's dive into some of these because, and actually there are some very encouraging things that are happening in the region. We'll talk about the Arab Spring and this incredible cadre of young people across the region that are demanding more and different. But let's stay on these two topics for a minute. First, Iran. You talk about crippling sanctions. There is a whole new series of sanctions the Europeans have signed on to and others. The Iranians appear to be concerned about this. They appear to be responding. First, what's going to make them crippling? And secondly, what are you watching for to determine whether they're really having the desired effect?
What makes them crippling in the first instance is, we've already seen, their currency has been devalued by half in the last 2 months. Now think about it. When the value of your currency is cut in half, it means everything anything you have in the bank is worth now half of what it was. Everything you're buying now costs you twice as much as it did. This is something that is spread across all of Iran and is felt by everybody.
Are the people feeling this on the streets?
Well, one of the indications of that is we actually saw, and this is another manifestation of what you were talking about in terms of the new Middle East, on YouTube, you could see demonstrations in front of Iranian banks. So, yes, this is being felt throughout all of Iran. The second important element, it's related, is the loss of revenue. Because the fact is, when the Europeans announced that they're going to boycott the purchase of Iranian oil starting July 1, the impact on the Iranians isn't felt only starting July 1. Today, the Iranians have put large amounts of oil on tankers out at sea. By the way, they won't have more tankers in another month to put it on. The reason is, some of their customers are demanding very big discounts in order to buy their oil. And the reason being, they know the Europeans aren't going to be your customers any longer. You still got to sell. And the Iranians don't want to sell at a price that's too low. Even though we've seen the price of oil go up, those who are pressing them right now for big discounts are not at this point buying, or at least they're choosing not to sell. So that's another manifestation of how they, at this point, how they're feeling it. You asked about an indication that this could be working. The measure, again, of diplomacy or, for that matter, the use of force, these are means to an end. They're not objectives. They're not ends in themselves. The objective is to change their behavior. Now, the indicator that I would be looking for, even before you get into negotiations, because the negotiations are going to determine, are they for real? Are they actually prepared now to talk about something and do something that would tangibly change the character of their program? We're not in negotiations yet. But given who the Supreme Leader is, his history, when he makes a big decision, is to widen the circle of decision-making, not narrow it. So he's building a consensus behind the decision he makes. It is interesting that this past week, Rafsanjani, who has been basically sidelined for the last year, was reappointed as head of the Expediency Council. This is one of those important institutions that's part of the Islamic Republic. And only a week before he was reappointed, he was making sounds like it was time for him to retire. So what happened in that week? Why does Rafsanjani, who has a history of being seen as being pragmatic, why does he suddenly emerge in this position? That's a good question. I can't totally answer it, but I'm saying to you, it could be suggestive as an indicator that maybe things are moving in the right direction. One other potential indicator, and I don't want to bank too much on this. When the Supreme Leader the week before last said that nuclear weapons are a sacrilege, the possession of them is a sin, he could have been simply trying to engage in a charm offensive to try to affect the rest of the world, or he could be laying a predicate for what could be an explanation later on to say, look, we never sought nuclear weapons. All we wanted was civil nuclear power. Now, the crux of this will be determined when we get into negotiations and we can see, and the key for the Supreme Leader is he more afraid of making a concession to us in the nuclear program for fear that will simply invite more pressure rather than less, and therefore he'll see that as being a threat to his hold on power, or does he believe that the pressure that's being built now becomes a threat to his hold on power? If he decides the latter, that the continuing pressure is a bigger threat than making concessions, then there'll be a diplomatic way out of this. If he decides on the former, that it's too costly from his standpoint to make concessions to us, then I'm afraid we're going to find that diplomacy is not going to be the
answer. And when you say there's a diplomatic way out of this, if the Iranians so choose, the only diplomatic way out is for the Iranians to say we're not, you know, we'll have peaceful nuclear power, not a nuclear weapon and weapons capability, and allow inspectors in to assure that, right? That's the only diplomatic way out.
Yeah, I would say the real diplomatic way out is they can have civil nuclear power, but there have to be what I would describe as firewalls, real firewalls that are created that they cannot translate that civil nuclear power into a nuclear weapons capability.
Friend, when you hear Dennis speaking, I mean, he's a diplomat. That's what he's paid to do or has been paid.
And we know that's not me.
But there are plenty of people
who... plenty of people who said I wasn't a diplomat either.
We'll get to them later. But there are plenty of people who have said, look, we've been down this road with the Iranians before. The Persians invented chess.
Right.
They play 3, 4, 5 moves down the line. They're playing for time now, because once they present the world with a fait accompli and it's too late to do anything about it, then it's too late to do anything about it. What's different now?
Well, I do think that the pressure of sanctions is having an impact on the Iranian view of the problem.
Which Iranian view, though?
I think the only one that matters. Let's start. There's only one that matters, and it's the Supreme Leader. Ahmadinejad is sort of noisy, tyrannical, but he's not the decision maker.
Yeah.
The president. He's not the decision maker. The Supreme Leader is, and so the question is, how sincere is he? That's difficult to judge until you're in negotiations, right? I think we have to remember, to your point, Frank, I think we have to remember our history. Going from Mossadegh to the Shah, all through our interactions with the Iranian regime, it has been a bit of a chess game. And so negotiations tend to be a ploy that allow them to buy time to further their own objectives. But that doesn't mean you don't go into negotiations. Despite that history, you go in with your eyes open. And so it's the old trust but verify regime of you've got to go in good faith to negotiate, and you have to wrap that inside a regime that allows you to actually verify through inspectors. And I will say, when Dennis talks about firewalls, one of the things, I won't get too technical here, but the fact is if you have a civilian nuclear program and you're enriching to 3.5%, okay. There is no good justification to be enriching to 20%.
Or to 90%.
Well, that's right. 90% is what you need for the weapons. Very easy, once you're at 20, very easy and very quick to get to 90%. And so we ought to be deeply skeptical when they're enriching and they've gotten 3 times the amount of enriched to 20% enriched uranium. We ought to be deeply skeptical that that has anything to do with the civilian program. And so when you're talking about firewalls, there are no good reason to have any at 20%.
Fran, you just came back from the region. I know you were Saudi Arabia, among other places. I want to get to that opinion in a minute. But first, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, was recently in the United States, had very frank talks with the President of the United States. And he made it plain that their patience isn't forever. How realistic do you think an Israeli military strike might be? And how imminent, despite all these negotiations, the Iranian capability?
I think for those who saw the CBS 60 Minutes interview of Meir Dagan, the former head of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, I think the Israelis understand that if you can solve this problem without military action, that is far preferable. And I think that's not just Meir Dagan, who's in a minority view right now in Israel, but I think the Israeli government understands that. The point is they're unwilling to allow the period of time when an attack could be effective to pass unless they have some assurance, real assurance, credible assurances that the Iranians have abandoned a weapons program. So I think we have to understand that, and look, Dennis has been deeply involved in negotiations with the Israelis and can speak directly to this, but there is no question from my conversations with senior Israeli officials, not only is this viewed as an existential threat, but you must understand that it is viewed through the prism of the Holocaust. I mean, a nuclear weapon detonated in Israel is tantamount to them to the Holocaust. And we have to understand that Ahmadinejad has said, Dennis quoted him, he wants to see Israel wiped off the face of the map. You know, pre-9/11, bin Laden said he was going to wage war on the United States, and everybody sort of rolled their eyes and said, how's he going to do that from some cave in Afghanistan? And then came 9/11. And so policymakers are pretty apt to take tyrants at their word, even if you don't understand how they're going to make true the capability. And so in that entire post-9/11 context, you can see this is a very real existential threat to the Israelis. They do have the capability to hit Iran's program and certainly delay it. The sooner they do that, the greater the delay they're likely to inflict because of sort of it won't be down so deep. And I think we have to understand that the Israelis will make that judgment in the near term. Netanyahu said it's not in days or weeks, but it's also not in years, signaling that they will make the decision that is in their best interest, not necessarily as the United States would wish them to.
Dennis, how long? How long do the negotiations have as far as the Israelis are concerned?
Well, I think we're looking at some time this year.
This year?
Yeah, this
so
year.
So if they don't succeed, we could have another war in the Middle East?
Yeah, but I think, absolutely, look, for the reasons that Fran said, you know, from an Israeli standpoint, this is an existential threat. No Israeli prime minister is going to forsake a military option facing an existential threat because the Israelis don't believe you contract out your security, especially for something that's so fundamental. Now, that said, they've also viewed this as not just Israel against Iran, but the world against Iran.
Why? So, but wait, let's just play a game here, because we can all understand where the Israelis are coming from. But there are those who say there's another option. You live with a North Korea armed with nuclear weapons. You live with an India and Pakistan armed with nuclear weapons. This thing called mutual assured destruction worked. It was a horrible way of working, but it worked. Right. What about containing Iran?
I think the problem with containing Iran is the following. People who draw from the Cold War example are looking at a bipolar example. And you're looking at a case where each side had the capacity, as horrible as it was, to absorb a nuclear strike and to respond. You're looking in the Middle East, and certainly in the case of Israel, but not only Israel, where nobody thinks they can absorb a first strike, so you can't afford to be the one to strike second, number one. Number two, you have all sorts of local triggers for conflicts. Think about the combination of local triggers for conflicts on the one hand and each side acting on a hair trigger on the other. Add to that, they don't have any means of communication, direct communication. We had means of communication with the Soviet Union, and in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were dramatically closer to nuclear war than either one of us realized. How about in a situation where there is no communication between the parties, you get into a crisis or a conflict, and you don't think you can afford to wait to strike, you see the other side beginning to change the alert level of your forces, you're suddenly in a Guns of August kind of scenario, only it's on steroids. You don't have time, and no one's going to intervene. So the danger of facing the real-life prospect of a nuclear war if Iran goes nuclear and the Israelis, you know, you have the Israeli position, the Saudis will get it, you're going to have a landscape that is totally different than it is today.
You were in Saudi Arabia. What were the Saudis saying about this?
Well, Frank, let me add to what Dennis is saying. I mean, It will and has already triggered something of a nuclear arms race in the region, which is frightening in and of itself. Remember, there was the nuclear reactor in Syria undeclared that was bombed. The Syrians never acknowledged it. But And to Dennis's point, certainly others in the region, the UAE now has a civilian nuclear capability. If you don't think that if Iran goes nuclear, that the Emirates isn't going to look to have a nuclear capability beyond the civilian one that they have now. And this is a very volatile region that isn't going to get more stable by virtue of nuclear weapons. Look, the region is on edge. There is no question, we have to understand that there is a bit of a struggle continuing, flowing out of Iraq, quite frankly, of a Sunni-Shia divide within Islam. Iran has always been the Shia power in the region. Saudi Arabia and Egypt have always been the sort of anchors of the Sunni world. Saudi Arabia, the king is referred to as the custodian of the two holy mosques, and so believes his leadership in the Islamic world. And so there is this tension. We've seen it inside Iraq. We're now seeing it being played out in a regional context between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
What did you hear from the Saudis when you were there? What are they saying about this?
The Saudis worry about 60% of the world's known oil reserves, mostly centered along the eastern province, that is the province closest to the Persian Gulf and to Iran, believe that they are vulnerable to a first strike. Where would the Iranians first strike if they wanted to have an impact on the West but not attack the West directly? They're most likely to attack our closest ally in the region. By the way, in the eastern province, while more than 95% of the population of Saudi Arabia is Sunni, the entire remaining 5% are in the eastern province and work in typically lower-level jobs in the oil sector in the eastern province. And so if you were to have the Shia rise in Saudi Arabia, it's likely to be in the eastern province and likely to affect oil. They see the first signs of that in Bahrain. No question that both the Saudi royal family, the Sunni, the Bahrain royal family, Sunni, see the uprising in Bahrain as symptomatic. It's a Shia-majority population in Bahrain ruled by a Sunni royal family, and they see the beginnings of Iranian activity fomenting the Shia in Bahrain as well. And so everyone is on edge. We've seen, even in the Emirates when I was there, again, a large expatriate Iranian community, largely a banking center in the region, and they too see an increasing activity of Iranians.
I'm going to ask the audience a question here. I'll let you vote by raising your hands, and then I'm going to ask you your response. Your response to this. Based on what you've heard and what you know from what you've been following, if you had to vote as to whether you thought negotiations and diplomacy with Iran will be successful and will defuse this or not, how many of you think diplomacy will be successful? How many of you do not think diplomacy will be successful? So I would say a majority think are pessimistic on this. If you had to vote with one side or the other and rate this, Dennis Ross, what would you say?
Well, I think that the odds for diplomacy working are not what I would like them to be. How's that for an artful answer?
Okay, you can see why I'm not the diplomat. I'm with the pessimist, so you can tell.
But
so I'm not quite sure which side you then take. But
no, I think the majority here, the instincts of the majority are probably right. I think the negotiations working, you know, it would be very hard to bet that the negotiations will work. Now, having said that, you know, Samuel Johnson said, nothing concentrates the mind like an imminent hanging. And the fact is, you know, and this also gets to the essence, of course, of diplomacy. The more it looks like you're facing an imminent hanging, the more you begin to look for ways out.
What do you think?
And I would have just one last point. Yeah. I think that there actually is more of a potential not to have a diplomatic outcome that's going to solve the problem, but I can envision a kind of interim step that stops the clock. What has us and the Israelis most concerned is that they cross a threshold where you lose the ability to act militarily. And the Israelis, if they fear they lose that, they can't really put themselves in that position. But if you stop the clock, then you don't have to worry about that as much. And the Iranians could have an interest in that.
Stopping the clock going to be enough? Which side do you take here?
Well, I wish I thought that negotiations would be successful. The fact is, I don't think diplomacy will succeed ultimately with the Iranians. But that doesn't mean you don't try. I don't want that to be misinterpreted. I do think we are in the best position to negotiate with them that we have been on this issue. I think it's going to get better as we get closer to July 1st with the oil and banking sanctions really digging in, and they're going to start to feel it in the pocketbook.
But you're not an optimist. I mean, they may feel it, but you don't think it's going to break the logjam.
I don't.
So do you see war as inevitable?
Having served in the White House during two wars, I can't get my head wrapped around that. I don't want to say that I think it's inevitable. Look,
you're worried about this.
I am very worried about it. But look, lest you think I really am an optimist. Syria. Let's look at Syria. You know, there was a bombing. It was unattributable. It disrupted their capability, and they didn't go back to it. The Syrians.
Oh, sorry.
Same could be true of Osirek,
yeah.
Right? And so there weren't wars fought over either of those facilities, and yet the capability was taken out. And so I do not think war is inevitable. I hope we can avoid a military action.
Okay, let's go to Syria now. Let's change gears a little bit. The situation is deteriorating. The violence is increasing. We're seeing these YouTube videos out. We actually have an eyewitness onto this, even though most journalists have been barred from the country now. Where is this going?
Well, I think where it has to go is that Assad has to leave, and I think the key is that he has to be accelerated. His departure has to be accelerated. I say that not only for the moral reasons that Fran was getting at, and what we're seeing is, as she put it quite correctly, these are unconscionable acts. I say it also even in terms of the future of Syria and the possible impact on the region. The longer this goes on, the more violent it will become, the more radicalized the opposition is going to be, meaning radicalized Islamists it's going to be, the more the problems there will radiate outward to the neighbors. And so we have, I would say, aside from a moral interest, we have a strategic interest in accelerating the process in terms of getting Assad out. And I do think there are things that can be done to accelerate that process, and I think they will need to be done. We can talk about that if you like.
What are they?
I think the actions fall into four different categories. The first category is we need the Arabs to put much more pressure on the Russians, because the Russians have created for Assad the image of an insurance policy. You got to change the balance of power within Syria and within the constituencies that are still, especially his security establishment, that are backing Assad. As long as they think they have an insurance policy, they feel they have a free ride and they can use their power against...
Okay, so more Arab pressure on the Russians.
More Arab pressure on the Russians, which is both negative but be positive, because they can say to the Russians, you can be the hero of the situation if you are the ones who manage the transition away from Assad. That's number one. Number two, we have to do more to anoint the Syrian opposition to create a sense of inevitability about them being the alternative.
Okay.
Number three, Assad has become a purely sectarian leader, meaning he is the head of a community, the Alawite community, which is 12% of the Syrian population, but they make up the majority of the security apparatus. Now, there needs to be an outreach to the Alawite population. It needs to come from the Turkish Alawites, who may be able to convey certain kinds of guarantees. It needs to come from the Saudis, who will convey it to different through different channels that there'll be no vengeance, no Sunni vengeance against the Alawis. So they can see that their real salvation is not sticking with Assad, but defecting from Assad. The third thing, The fourth thing, I don't count well, but it's...
You're a hell of a negotiator.
Well, that's... absolutely. Particularly on numbers. But the fourth thing is Assad is not Gaddafi. This guy is not going to lead an underground if he thinks that, you know, the balance is shifting against him. He's going to leave. What we have to do is we have to convince him that the options he thinks have not been on the table are on the table. So if that means that you have to actually prepare the capability for humanitarian corridors or for safe havens, as difficult as that may be, then that needs to be done. If it means providing lethal assistance to an opposition, which is problematic because the opposition is not coherent. You don't have high confidence about exactly who's going to get the weapons and then how they'll be used. But you think about, all right, can you work with Turkey? Can you work with Jordan so that you can more effectively transmit such assistance and you can target it? And I think the last thing I would say is there's more that we could do to provide communications capabilities for the Syrian opposition to the Free Syrian Army, but also the more we could do to disrupt the communications of the Syrian army.
Friend, there's got to be a chateau in the south of France that Assad would like to live in. But what is your sense of what it's really going to take? He is entrenched, the Alawites are entrenched, and they see this as their existential threat.
Right. It's interesting. Just today, there was a report on Al Arabiya, which is an Arab-Saudi media outlet, that reported that the Russians were now providing special forces and counterterrorism forces and mentors to the Assad regime in Syria. We don't know whether or not that report is true, but it suggests, to Dennis's point, that the Saudis and the Arabs are beginning to put more pressure on the Russians. That is a good thing. Some of these things I am frustrated that we have not already done. We should be providing for a humanitarian corridor.
We who?
We, the United States, working with our Arab allies. Look, this is one where we really need our Arab allies who understand the tribal differences and the strengths and weaknesses inside Syria. One of the Saudi king's wives was Syrian. He has sons who are in the government. One is the deputy foreign minister, one of the king's sons in Saudi Arabia, whose mother was Syrian. They have deep ties into Syria and can be extraordinarily helpful. And so we must motivate our Arab allies to take a leadership role, which is not something they typically want to do. They can help us in terms of the humanitarian corridor and getting refugees out of Syria who wish to leave. We must have international observers. Look, it's understandable. Governments around the world remove diplomats for their own safety, frankly, as the security situation deteriorated. But that wasn't necessarily a bad thing for the Assad regime. The eyes and ears of the world were gone. We should have argued sooner for the protection and entry of journalists from around the world to bear witness to this atrocity. Not only those who got in snuck in, and some arguably were targeted and killed. And as long as there are not eyes and ears to bear witness, it is easier for the world to ignore. Some of that information is getting out now because of social media and videos, but we must do more. I fear the longer we wait, I do think we have a strategic interest. Dennis mentioned it. You will find the opposition to become far more radicalized and extremist if they are left to try and fend on their own. We must consider arming the Syrian opposition. We must do it quickly. And in the end, if we fail to act, I think, and I think it's a very difficult position for President Obama to be in, because in the end, he has said we won't be bystanders. We, by and large, over the past year, have been. And if we fail to act, it may be for him that Syria becomes what Rwanda was for President Clinton, not in the numbers, we hope, of those killed, but in terms of the magnitude of the tragedy and our unwillingness to act.
Now, when you say something like that, and we're going to go to audience questions in a minute, and there's so much to talk about here, the Arab Spring, Israeli-Palestinian, but when you say something like that, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign. So we have intensified political pressures on these issues here at home. Is this going to become something we actually hear about in a big way on the campaign trail, do you think? I mean, if you're suggesting that President Obama could be playing with his Rwanda, that's a very serious charge or issue or fear.
No, I say he's in a very difficult situation. I don't expect you're going to hear about it on the campaign trail. Political seasons lend themselves to sort of good one-liners that are sharp and pithy, but they don't really give themselves over to real policy solutions.
You mean we're not getting smart from the campaign?
Yeah, I don't think so. listen, when we're down to debating whether or not it's okay for a man to call a woman a slut in public, I mean, really? So, no, I don't think... I don't think we're going to get real smart. Nobody's going to raise their IQ listening to the presidential campaign.
Well, what a great segue. But they will raise their IQ by listening to this conversation and by listening to the questions that have come to us from the audience. I want to take a moment, though, to recognize the question review team, which has helped so much with this, the people who are responsible for selecting the questions that will be presented from the audience to our speakers. So if I may ask you to please hold your applause until I introduce the entire group. They are Royal Calkins. He's editor of the Monterey County Herald, Fran Gaver. She's an attorney with Leach and Walker. Doug McKnight, he's a reporter for KAZU Radio. And Don Miller, he's editor-in-chief with the Santa Cruz Sentinel. We also have here with us a group of students representing those who attended the forum that we attended earlier today. And it was a terrific student program, more than 600 students in the room asking fabulous questions of these two very knowledgeable individuals. So at this time, I'd like to ask all of the students here who are in attendance this evening to stand. All of the students, please stand. And remain standing. I will put you on the spot because I'd like you to remain standing while I recognize each of the schools represented. There are 16 schools, and they are Everett Alvarez High School, Alisal High School, Cabrillo College, the California Maritime Academy, California State University, Monterey Bay, Defense Language Institute, Monterey County Home Charter School, Monterey Institute of International Studies, Naval Postgraduate School, North Salinas High School, Notre Dame High School, San Jose State University, Santa Catalina High School, Santa Clara University, Santa Cruz High School, and the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thank you all very, very much. So now I'm going to start to weave these questions in, and I'll come back to some of these other things. Consider this a little bit of the lightning round so we can get... look at all these questions we've got here so we can get to as many of them as we can, and they'll be mixed up a bit. Fran, I'm going to direct this one to you. How much of a threat... This is a student question. How much of a threat do you consider cyber terrorism to be in the world today, and who's likely, most likely, to utilize the threat?
Okay. I think cyber terrorism will be the next generation of policymakers. That is, look, our time is pretty much past. It will be your greatest threat. It is unlikely to be a terrorist threat in the first instance. I think it's much more likely to be a state-on-state. Why? Because terrorists tend to use the Internet to their advantage, and so you're likely to see it to be a state-on-state. Who are the countries with the greatest capability? Russia and China. We've seen both use it. By the way, the other, probably the top capability is ours. I can't talk about how and when we use it, but we do. To great effect, I might add. And so, but I think the next...
We would do such a thing?
There's gambling in the back of the church, Frank. I do think it will be the Pearl Harbor of the next generation of policymakers.
Cyber terrorism.
That's
will
right.
Be...
That's right.
And what
because,
would it,
well, imagine.
What would
I,
it
I want.
Look like?
I want. I, how many people here have and use an ATM card? Raise your hand. Okay. Imagine the day that you go in. That's the only way I bank. Imagine you're going in, putting it in, it eats your card, you can't get it back, and that happens to everybody who just raised their hand on the same day. The financial system is...
And it's happening to large institutions. You
right.
shut the whole system down.
Meltdown, complete meltdown. And so if you really want it... Now, before you all walk out of here and everybody's banks go crazy, the fact is some of the best cybersecurity by sector is in the banking sector because they realize how important your confidence in their system is. But if you want to think about, and we've modeled it, suppose all of a sudden the lights, remember? Do you remember the blackout on the Northeast Corridor? Suppose we didn't know when that first happened. I was in the White House. I'll never forget the day as the rolling blackout begins and I see the visual picture of people running across the Brooklyn Bridge out of Manhattan, and all of a sudden you're reliving 9/11.
And
again.
You're thinking, oh, my God, this could be...
That's right. That was my first thought.
It was a squirrel.
Right.
Or something,
it was an infrastructure problem. But those are the sorts of things. Imagine generators and electricity in hospitals starting to shut down. Imagine your cell phone system being taken out.
Dams being opened.
Right.
Electric.
So this is a huge concern and a huge vulnerability.
Are we ready for it?
No. We're not. And there's a big debate right now in Congress about cybersecurity legislation. And this is one of these. I thank Senators Collins and Lieberman for pushing this legislation and bringing attention to it. But my fear is, like many of the authorities in the Patriot Act, which had been proposed but not passed, until post 9/11, I very much worry that the government will not get the authorities it needs until post an event.
Very, very quickly, though, what is the one most important thing or the two most important things you think the government needs to prevent this kind of Pearl Harbor?
Well, it's not so easy.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to do that to you.
But give us
some sense of what you think it would take to stop that, prevent that.
Well, it requires a level of insight and transparency between the government and the providers, the ISP providers, your internet service providers, and coordination between them that is lacking.
Dennis, next question for you. This is from someone in the audience here. It seems the Obama administration has backed down on its objections to Israeli settlements. Can you explain why this change? And do you think this change is a positive or negative change as it affects the entire Middle Eastern political situation?
First, I don't think the Obama administration has backed down on its objections to Israeli settlement activity. It still will express those objections. The fact is, this administration, like all of its predecessors, has looked at the settlement activity and seen it as being very problematic in terms of being able to enhance the prospects of making peace. The reason for that is Palestinians look at this as an Israeli activity that they can do, and it makes the Palestinians feel powerless. Now, having said that, if I were to ask you how much territory do the settlements actually take up, my guess is most people in the audience would guess a very high percentage of the land of the West Bank, correct? If you were to learn that the actual amount of territory in the West Bank that settlements take up is 1.9% of the territory, would that surprise you? That doesn't surprise you? Boy, you're very well informed. The fact is, the argument that somehow the settlements are precluding an agreement, that's just not a fact. Psychologically, they have an effect for sure. Politically, they have an effect for sure. The best way to get at this is to resolve the border. Once you resolve what the border is, then where the Israelis are building is no longer an issue. When the president presented two speeches last May, he outlined principles for resolving the territorial question, meaning the border, and security. The idea was to address what the Palestinians wanted in a general sense, a principal sense as it related to territory, address what the Israelis needed in a principal sense, an essential sense, and what they needed on security, to create a foundation for resolving not just the settlement problem, but to create a foundation so you could then take on what I call the emotive narrative issues
right.
of Jerusalem and refugees. So the Obama administration did not back off of the settlement issue, but it sought to say, you know, rather than treat the settlements, which is the way, frankly, the Palestinians have treated them, as a symbol, let's see if we can resolve the issue. Let's get into negotiations, and let's get into negotiations with these principles to guide territory and security so that we can make the settlement issue an issue of the past.
You've negotiated both with Bibi Netanyahu and with Mahmoud Abbas. Is one flexible enough and the other strong enough to make the compromises necessary?
You know, the way I answer that question is to look at the psychological context that exists today. I want to give you an example of just where we really are, because that context affects both leaders. 78%, a recent poll 2 weeks ago, 78% of the Israeli public, when asked a question not only about a two-state outcome, but actually about accepting a two-state outcome along the lines of the Clinton parameters, said yes. 78%. The same 78% said it'll never happen. Now, there are polls on the Palestinian side. There are mirror images of that, not quite 78%, but 70%, that basically will accept the same two-state outcome, the same basic elements to produce it, and the same 70% say it'll never happen. You have right now Palestinian perceptions that are driven by a belief that the Israelis will never really accept their independence, and you have Israeli perceptions of the Palestinians saying they will never really accept us as a Jewish state. They may believe in two states, but one is Palestinian, the other is binational. So as long as the context is driven by that kind of psychological disbelief, it's unlikely to get leaders to take big steps. So the challenge, and I wrote an article on this shortly after I left the government, the challenge, if it's hard to produce a political breakthrough, is to think about how do you change the dynamic? And one way to change the dynamic is don't focus on the settlement issues per se. Focus on ways to show the Palestinians that Israeli control and occupation will end at some point by taking steps on the ground that relate to levels of Israeli control. 60% of the West Bank is pretty much not available for the Palestinians for economic activity. So make that available for economic activity. Increase the Palestinian police presence in another 20% of the West Bank that's called Area B. Come to an agreement on the security criteria so that the Israelis wouldn't have a need to send their forces back into Area A, where the Palestinians pretty much have civil and security responsibility. In return, the Palestinians could say, all right, we're not going to go to the UN. We're not going to go to the international agencies. We're not going to go to the ICJ and the ICC and put Israel in the docket. Each side could take steps that would begin to rebuild faith in peacemaking, because what's happened is they've lost faith in peacemaking, and that pretty much denies the political wherewithal for leaders to take big steps.
And that doesn't happen because there's so much mistrust, because the United States is not taking enough of a lead, because each side is locked into its own politics. Why?
I think a variety of factors, but don't underestimate the impact of the Arab Spring. For the Israelis, they look out, and what do they see? That with Egypt, they had cold peace, but they had cold peace. Now, what's the future going to hold for them in Egypt? For Mahmoud Abbas, the strongest single Arab leader who gave him support was Mubarak.
Mubarak
is gone. What does he see? Not only is Mubarak gone, but he sees the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he thinks, if I take a step right now, I'm going to face a huge backlash. So why should I take that risk? So from an Israeli standpoint, you're looking out at enormous new uncertainties. You know, it's not only Egypt, but Fran was talking about Syria and the 40 chemical and biological sites. You know, you're Israel and you're saying, a lot of uncertainty, this isn't exactly the time to take a risk. If you're Abu Mazen, you say, Muslim Brotherhood on the rise, I look like I'm taking a step towards negotiations, they're going to come down on me like a ton of bricks, who needs it? And then they look at their own psychological context and they say, this isn't the time to take risks. So the U.S. being very active doesn't answer that. We have to think about how do we change the dynamic.
Fran, how does the Arab Spring change the dynamic?
Well, I think we often express sort of frustration that there was this very hopeful rising of a young population using social media and very idealistic, and it hasn't all turned out exactly as we would have it in a short period of time. Well, our own history of democracy was pretty bloody and pretty messy in the beginning. And so we have to expect that this is going to take some time to sort itself out, one. Two, however it does sort itself out may not look like the Jeffersonian version of democracy that you're living with here in the United States. Each country will adopt its version of what these freedoms mean and what its priorities are. And third, it's going to take time. Most of these countries have no history of civil institutions to fall back on. They don't. In Libya, I can tell you, I met with Gaddafi during the Bush administration. He ruled with an iron fist, and there was no civil institutions and concept of rule of law, respect for individual rights. It didn't exist.
No, it's really interesting. A few years ago, I attended a conference. It was an international conference of journalists. And there were several journalists there from the Middle East. And what they said almost to a person was, look, you talk to us about what a free press should be. Here's what you need to understand about where we come from. You're written into the Constitution. You have guarantees. Your courts have upheld your freedoms. You have journalism schools and NGOs and others that protect you. We have no protection. We have no institutional protection in our country. And that goes across all the institutions. So it's a huge, huge undertaking.
That's right. And so when you think of something like what happened, what we saw in Egypt and the charges against NGOs, the work of NGOs in this region as they sort their way through the Arab Spring is critically important. And that fear, that intimidation of NGOs in Egypt will reverberate around the region at a time when they so desperately need this sort of advice.
About that messy democracy you talked about, because democracy is messy and already has been in the region, right? You can end up with free elections that bring Islamists, even extremists, to office. Is that a good thing for the United States of America and the world?
Well, you know what?
Or just this another thing that keeps you up at night.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, during the Bush administration, there was a debate about whether or not Palestinian elections should be put off. And the answer was no, and Hamas won. And so there was much recrimination, given that Hamas is a terrorist organization, it's supported and funded by and large by the Iranians. How do we feel about that? And you know, it's interesting. President Bush, who had been an advocate throughout his both terms, but especially he devoted much of his second inaugural speech to the freedom agenda, his attitude was, you know, that's the whole point of democracy. They may not elect who we would elect for them, but it's their choice. And it was understandable. When you look at why Hamas prevailed in that election, the fact was Hamas was the only entity delivering local services, whether that was healthcare clinics or kindergartens, services to the people in those neighborhoods, and that's how they got elected.
The United States of America is pouring billions of dollars into the region. The United States of America pours over $1 billion a year into Egypt. If they go to the polls and they vote a government that's fundamentally hostile to the United States of America and to Western interests in the region, then what?
Well, I think the critical question is, are we going to have repeatable elections? One thing has changed in this world, in the Middle East, in the last year. Prior to the last year, the people in the Middle East saw themselves as subjects. They were acted upon. They were imposed upon. In the last year, they see themselves as citizens for the first time. Now, it's true they don't have the civil institutions to play out being a citizen, but they have a voice. For the first time in the last 40 years, they have a voice. They show very little sign of being willing to give up that voice. Now, what it means is, if you're the Muslim Brotherhood and you come to power in Egypt, you're not going to be able to rule like Mubarak. You're going to have to govern. And if you have to govern, you're going to have to deliver. And if you're going to have to deliver, you're going to need help from the outside. If you need help from the outside, you better live up to your obligations, number one. Number two, we, and it can't just be us alone, we have to work internationally to create what I call standards of accountability so that politically you have a competitive political space. You respect minority rights. You respect women's rights. You ensure that, in fact, there is pluralism, so others are permitted to compete. When it comes to the economy, you don't criminalize the private sector. You know, you're going to have to create an environment where if you're going to attract investment from the outside, there has to be a rule of law. They will have to play by a certain set of rules if they want help, but even more if they want help, if they're going to deliver. One of the interviews that I was struck by more than any of that, and I read a whole series of them of people who voted in the elections in Egypt. And in one of the poorest neighborhoods, one woman who voted for the Muslim Brotherhood was asked, why did you vote for the Muslim Brotherhood? And she said, because they're not corrupt and because they'll build housing. Well, guess what? If what they do is pursue an ideological approach and they want to blame us or the Israelis or others for why they're failing, then they're repeating the pattern of the past and they won't build one house. Now, if they don't control all the means of coercion, if people don't lose their voice, you know, then you have the potential to have things evolve over time. When you talk about it being messy, what we're talking about is, yeah, the Islamists have all the advantages right now because they were the only ones who were allowed to organize. You know, you had regimes that were not legitimate. Because they weren't legitimate, they couldn't take on the mosque. So in the mosque, you were free to say what you wanted. In the mosque, you were free to organize. In the mosque, you could organize social services. In the mosque, you weren't corrupt. Now, guess what? They had nobody to compete against. Because if you were liberal, you were a threat to the regime. You weren't allowed to organize. And so the only ones who were in a position where they could take advantage of the vacuum that was created by removing a Mubarak or Ben Ali were the Islamists. Now, if there aren't going to be repeatable elections, then we're going to have a very dismal future in the Middle East. But if there are going to be, and if people don't lose their voice, and I don't see why they would right now, then there's a potential over time. So I don't think that we should despair. I also don't think we should be overly enthusiastic about who we see being elected. But I think they're going to have to, I don't see them giving up their ideology, but if they want to maintain themselves in government, then they're going to have to deliver. And we and others have an interest in creating those standards of accountability so they seep into the bloodstream among the new citizens of the region.
More questions in a minute, but are you an optimist or a pessimist based on this?
It depends what your time frame is, Frank. I think in the near term, I'm reasonably pessimistic in the sense of it's going to be messy, and you're going to see people elected that are not necessarily allies and friends of the United States or want to be our allies. I think over the longer term, I agree, I am more optimistic. I agree with Dennis. I think citizens who have found their voice and by virtue of technology, the means to express themselves, even under oppressive regimes, they will not give that up, and they will continue to use that.
Which takes me to my next question, which is a student question, but I'm going to precede it again by turning to the audience to ask you a couple of questions. I did this earlier today. How many of you in the room have a smartphone? Okay. How many of you in the room have downloaded or watched a YouTube video? Okay, that's pretty much everybody. How many have a Facebook page?
Wow.
Look at that. That's great stuff. All right, so here's the question from a student. I'm going to send this one to you. What lessons should young Americans learn from the Arab Spring movements? How should we be using social media to affect domestic and foreign policy and hold our leaders accountable?
I think it's fabulous. You're talking to somebody. Yes, I have a Facebook page. Yes, I tried to friend my oldest son, who's 16. And
he said, forget it.
Yeah, exactly. He ignored my request.
Imagine that.
Shocking.
Look, I actually think it's an important lesson because it applies equally whether you're in Egypt or Tunisia or you're in Chicago, Monterey, Washington. You absolutely, it is a means of leverage. It is a means of finding others in a like-minded community who care about an issue and want to apply influence. Look, President Obama in 2008 cracked the code in a way no other candidate had ever done about the use of social media. And he saw the benefits of that. I work in the private sector. I work across a group of portfolio companies as different as Revlon Cosmetics to the sale of Humvees by AM General. All use social media, every one of them. And all companies now are moving in that direction. Why? Because you use Facebook, you use Twitter, and your friends, and you develop these communities, and you make recommendations. And what all the marketing studies show is that you will accept the recommendation of someone you know and respect, a friend or a colleague or someone in your community of interest, far away above sort of a general advertisement. And so it applies in a political context. It applies in a commercial context. This is an incredibly powerful vehicle for you to express and influence outcomes.
So Dennis, the theme of this year's Panetta Institute conversation, revolutions of the 21st century changing our way of life. Does this social media thing that she just talked about, this accountability, whether it's at the corporate level or the governance level, is this a revolution? Is this going to change our way of life?
Well, I think it already has changed our way of life. We see it economically. We see it socially. We see it, as you know better than anybody, in terms of the way people get their news. So it already has.
No, they do, actually.
They do.
Yes, they go to what they want, what
absolutely
they can find instantly.
Right, and that will build new models for the way a lot of things are done. We have to see it express itself politically. The essence of the question was, how does it, in the end, express itself politically? Well, if you use some of the social media to organize around an idea, and that idea goes truly viral and it has political implications, you can bet that political leaders are going to pay attention to it. So we haven't seen that so much in terms of the larger political issues that we look at, but the potential is there because we see it affecting everything else.
And the most recent example is one here in California. Prior to about 2 weeks ago, who here knew who Joseph Kony was? You all know Kony 2012. Probably most of you have seen the video. It's incredible.
And the Ugandan leader was on television today having made a rebuttal.
Via YouTube. Right.
That's right. President Obama's last news conference, last town hall, was a Google town hall.
Right.
All right? But does this actually make leaders, whether they're in Syria, Iran, or the United States of America more accountable to their publics?
I not only believe it does, I believe that's why some governments try to filter their internet, whether it's China or Iran or Saudi Arabia. All have internet filters, all try to control access to the international, to the gateways, for a good reason.
Look, it's interesting, I just might add to that. Iran is helping Assad in a lot of ways, but one of the main ways is to try to disrupt the internet and all the social media.
But what's really interesting is that at similar times in other countries' turbulent histories, where they have tried to lock down information, they've been able to do that. We are still seeing some of these, you know, these YouTube videos, these citizen videos, these cell phone videos getting out. That's largely how the world knows what's going on and is seeing it. Back to the region, Fran Townsend, for you, a question from the audience tonight. The killing of Osama bin Laden has been hailed as eliminating a great threat to the United States. How much has the threat actually been decreased?
Well, bin Laden was this incredible icon in the radical community. He was a force for fundraising, for recruitment, so that he was sort of the head. He had, because he was obviously taking some precautions, removed himself somewhat, not as much as the intelligence community believed, but had somewhat removed himself from the day-to-day operations. Communicating with him was slower, harder, more risky. He understood that, and so it was harder for him to exercise the day-to-day control. But there's no question. Here's my problem. It's like the octopus, right? You've lopped off the head, but there are tentacles. Very dangerous tentacles. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who the underwear bomber came from there. You've got Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And we see in East Africa, in Nigeria, you see growing in North Africa, you see their capability. So they remain very dangerous pieces to it. The struggle, our war against them, is by no means over, but you've really undermined their ability to have a centralized form of command and control by removing bin Laden, who was really an iconic.
How dangerous is Al-Qaeda today?
Well, it's funny. You still refer to them as Al-Qaeda, as though it is a big central organization. I think the big central organization is less dangerous. Zawahiri is not the charismatic leader that bin Laden was. I do think that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who've demonstrated both the intent and the capability to strike inside the U.S. homeland, remain very dangerous.
Okay, next question from the audience. Dennis Ross, for you. How dramatic will the impact be of Staff Sergeant Robert Bale's alleged victims, the killings in Afghanistan, have on U.S. efforts in that country?
Well, I think it's a tragedy in of itself. And coming on the heels of the inadvertent Quran burning, which came on the heels of our having a couple of soldiers, officers actually, executed by Afghans they were working with. We're in a difficult place there. But, you know, I still believe that there is a way to manage our transition out of Afghanistan. Let's understand, we are transitioning out of Afghanistan. The transition is designed to put the Afghans in a position where they can provide for their own security. We want to do this in a way that ensures that we don't see a reemergence of the very problem that required us to go in there in the first place. You know, it isn't just that we've expended a huge amount of blood and treasure. From a very practical standpoint, we know what the consequences are. If somehow you end up with some variant of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban sort of cooperating again, and using this as a base from which they can carry out acts of terror, not only regionally, but internationally, including against us. We are in a position where we have the potential now, given what has been done to Al-Qaeda and the organization, and frankly, what's also been done to the Taliban, to create a situation where, in fact, the Afghans can put themselves in such a position. It's difficult because there's a lot of internal pressures within Afghanistan that are understandable, and trying to reconcile exactly the pace at which we do this transition is something that's going to require, I think, constant fine-tuning. So we're certainly in a much more difficult place because of these recent shocks and traumas. But the fact is, progress has been made, and now we have to find ways to deal with what's just happened.
Can I just make one collateral point, Frank? I make no excuses or apologies for the massacre of the Afghan civilians. There is none to be made. But I would say this. We ought to take a step back and look at the impact. Sergeant Bales had 4 deployments, a young family, and so we need to understand the impact, the protracted impact of a protracted deployment, that is 4 deployments, the impact on the individual, whether it's PTSD or traumatic brain injury, not enough attention has been paid to those issues, and the impact on military families. This man has a wife and children, and they are collateral damage into this.
Can I ask another thing? I mean, we, apropos of what Fran said, we as a country don't pay enough attention to the fact that we are relying upon a very small number of people to pay an enormous price to absorb all the sacrifice. It isn't enough just to applaud these people. We need to take account of the kind of pressures and stresses they're under. You know, he snapped. We don't know the full story. We don't know why he snapped. We don't know if it's because of the 4th deployment or not. We don't know if he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. But we do know that we have a very small number of people who are the ones carrying this huge burden. And we as a country owe them more than we've given them.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting that you raise this, Dennis, and it quickly gets into a very difficult conversation to have, because you say this at the very moment that we are looking at deep budget cuts that could reduce defense spending even more. We're looking at global deployments that stress the military more. We're looking at a diplomatic corps that is pushed and stressed but doesn't have the training or the protection that the military has. In many cases, they go to an embassy and they're wrapped in their little security bubble and they can't even get out. It raises profound questions about what American leadership really is going to look like in this 21st century. And I wonder if you would both zoom out a little bit and take the big picture of that, because that is one of the big questions facing our changing way of life in this new century. What is American leadership meant to look like? Are we still the leader of the free world? Are we still the world's policeman? Can we be?
Well, look, first you've got to say to yourself, if you were to pull back, right? So look at your options. If you were to pull back, is there someone who will step up and fill that vacuum? Well, the answer is this economic crisis has hit our partners in Europe. No one has ever shown a real ability or willingness to step up and fill that void. And you want to make sure what you're protecting are not only your security interests, but your values and your view of the world. And so I do think that we have to understand that there's a price to be paid not to take that leadership
role. I understand that, but I guess my question is, do you see a fundamentally different sort of American leadership in a 21st century that now has a rising China, a rising India, a rising Brazil, new powers, new dynamics around the world?
Right, but it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, I think we talk about it as though it is some zero-sum game. Yes, there will be rising powers. Yes, we want them to be our allies, and we want to find areas of common interest that we can work on with them. Does that mean there will be, that we won't have differences? No, we will. But I do think as you look through budget deficits and looming budget cuts, we must remember that not all cuts are equal, right? So if you care about your security interests, you want to make sure you don't underinvest in intelligence, which is your eyes and your ears and your early warning system to prevent bad things from happening. When you're looking at military budget cuts, you can cut big programs, but what you don't want to cut are your people, right? Because you can't regrow that expertise and that capability quickly. And so you want to make sure that you have the people and the resources they need to get the mission done.
Dennis, how do you see American leadership in the 21st century unfolding?
You know, I'm going to take a step back. You know,
You're going to not answer the question.
No, I'm going to answer the question by offering some perspective on it. We have a tendency to sort of take snapshots, look at the snapshot, and then draw these huge conclusions from them. Take a step back. In the 1970s, you know, the critics of what Henry Kissinger was doing on détente was that basically he was presiding over an American decline, and the Soviets were going to emerge as the great new superpower. You know, it wasn't going to be a case of parity. It was going to be, they were even going to be stronger than us. Well, we know what happened to the Soviet Union. I like to say that, you know, I was first trained as a Soviet specialist, and it tells you something about the age of a person when a country they're a specialist on doesn't exist any longer. But so in the 1970s, it was going to be the Soviets. Then in the 1980s, it was Japan. Remember?
Yes, I sure do.
They were coming here. They were buying everything. It was going to be Japan.
Japan Inc.
Japan Inc. Then in the 1990s, okay, we had what was seen as a unipolar world, meaning us. And that was never going to be sustainable on its own. The point is that there's a constant tendency to presume that somehow we're in decline and we're not going to be able to manage. And I don't see that. You know, yes, we face a lot of hard choices right now. Yes, we have to get our act together on the budget. But the fact is, no one else will play the role that we do internationally. Maybe we can't play it quite the way we did before. Maybe we have to think about how we shape new coalitions. But you can bet that the Chinese, if they want to be able to have a certain place in the world, they're going to have to play by certain sets of rules. The Chinese want to have greater reach. India wants to have greater reach, but you don't see them acting as if they want to assume greater responsibility. So we will continue to have to play a certain kind of role. And the fact is, all the sort of doomsayers about American decline, I've seen it before, and I don't buy it.
No, I agree. I think that's exactly right.
We have a few minutes left. I'd like to explore with you some of your own incredible personal experiences and your reflections on what you've seen. You were at the White House during a phenomenally difficult time as we went to war, waged two wars coming out of 9/11, which wounded us so deeply. You went into a pressure cooker every day. Was there a day, was there a moment that stands out above all others as the most difficult or the most vexing that you experienced?
Let me take you back to August of 2006, what became known as the transatlantic airline threat. It's the one, the women in the audience will remember it, is when you began not being able to take more than 3 ounces of your foundation. Sorry. So it was the liquid bombing threat. And so the short version of the threat was there was this cell in London identified by our British intelligence allies. And they were experimenting with this liquid that they would take into about a dozen planes while they were up over the Atlantic coming from London. And they would mix them, the component pieces, in a bathroom in the plane, and they would start blowing these planes up.
And they could take a plane down with this? This had the capability?
That's what we believed at the time, that it would blow a hole in the side of the plane and likely take the plane down. There were a whole bunch of problems with this, Frank, right? I said, do we know what the liquid is? Yes, we did. So literally we had bomb experts mock it up. It was in an old Tang bottle, for those of you who remember the drink. You know, it's a colored liquid, sort of the Gatorade of the 70s and 80s. But the only difference, and because I had them make it for me and then bring me a real bottle, and was the viscosity. It was thicker. It was more like a syrupy inside. And so the screeners were going to be confronted, even if you could tell them what the threat looked like. Literally, can you see the screeners at your screening station doing this, trying to figure out if it was too thick? And so we understood that there was a very deliberate plan. By the way, let me add to that, the planes leaving London Heathrow for the United States take off in a window of about 2.5 hours in the morning. There's a point in the day where they're all up over the Atlantic at the same time. And what we knew was if they got through and one plane blew up, I knew I was going to be sitting at my desk for the next 45 minutes, and all I could do was watch the other 11 blow up.
You had intelligence that this was a threat.
Yes. So we were watching the plot develop. We were watching the cell develop. We were relying on our British colleagues. And each day, I would pull together in a very small West Wing office in the basement with a low ceiling. I would get together all the security officials, the head of CIA, the head of FBI, the director of national intelligence, and we would say, are we confident that we can let the investigation continue and let the next day's planes fly without revealing the plot and taking it down? Understanding that many of our fellow citizens would be on those planes. And this is one of these, if you're wrong, thousands of Americans are going to be killed. It's the height of the travel season, vacation season. including, by the way, if you think this doesn't get pretty personal pretty quick, the then deputy press secretary, later press secretary, and her husband were going to be on one of those flights. Steve Hadley, the national security advisor's daughter, was on a college trip coming back on one of those flights. My aunt was coming back. And there's this what's called a no double standard rule, which means
we're tight on time. So
okay, we couldn't tell anybody to not take those flights that was personal to us. In the end, we let this plot play out over the course of several days, every day watching, praying. It turned out, Frank, it would have been easier for any one of my colleagues in that room to say, take the plot down. But it wasn't the right thing because we needed to understand the entire cell. If we had been wrong, we would have been up before Congress. We would have been testifying about the mistakes that we made that resulted in Americans being killed. But nobody made the personal decision to say, no, it would be bad for me, so let's just take the plot down. Everybody, every public servant made the call that was right for the country to get to the bottom of the threat until we played it out.
Dennis, you have 60 seconds. And you can't top this department, but I know you can. I'm sorry, but we're up against the clock.
All right, well, if you ask me what's the one day I remember more than any other, unfortunately, it was the most traumatic day for me personally, the Rabin assassination. I spent an enormous amount of time with Rabin. He was the pivot to the Oslo process. I had seen him 3 days before the assassination. His last words to me were, Dennis, expect anything. I didn't expect that.
That was certainly a terribly tragic and game-changing event. It really was. I'm going to ask you each now in about 15 or 20 seconds to speak to the young people in this audience, many of whom want to follow you or chart their own course into public life, which so often we hear is coarsened and frustrating and difficult and what's the point anymore. But you did it, and they will do it. What are your words to them?
Well, I would say, yes, it's demanding in a lot of ways, but I'll tell you, you'll do nothing that is more satisfying to you, will give you more of a sense of purpose and accomplishment than to engage in public service. I spent 25 years doing it. I don't have a regret for any of it.
Fran.
Exactly what he said, and I would say to you, do not be daunted by the fact that each of us spent more than two decades of service. You can go in, you can serve for 2, 3, 4 years, make a difference, but don't feel like you have to commit your whole professional life. You can go in and contribute, even for a short period.
Both of you have made an incredible difference. I mean, you really are living examples of that, and I hope that the students and the young people in this room will believe in this system, maybe even in journalism, in telling the story and getting the truth out, too, and commit to that. That is all the time we have. This is a complex discussion that could go on for a very long time. But thanks to Dennis Ross, to Fran Townsend, I'm Frank Sesno. On behalf of the Panetta Institute, good night.